Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
Today we are joined by Dennis Price. And Dennis is a person who has been focusing on the missing years of Jesus. What I like about this concept is the fact that in the last few years, if not decades, so many people have been focusing on whether or not Jesus died at the cross, and if he didn't, where did he go? But people are beginning to fail to see a very important aspect, which is, how did Jesus come about? Because really, the Jesus of the Bible has got an awful lot of missing years. And very much like Kathleen, Dennis has been looking into oral traditions in his native England and has come up with some wonderful conclusions, which he has presented in a book which is called The Missing Years of Jesus. And The Missing Years of Jesus has been published by Hay House, and it's also a website, which is themissingyearsofjesus.com. So, Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Philip, and good afternoon to you.
Hello, Dennis. I'm so excited to have you with us today.
That's very kind of you, Kathleen. The feeling's mutual. It really is. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is, as everyone knows, a subject that is incredibly near and dear to my heart. And you have done extraordinary research, I think, more than anyone really has done in this particular aspect, which is, did Jesus come to the UK during his childhood and his younger years? And before we get started, I just have to tell you, I went into Google and I put Blake did these feet into the Google search, and your website comes up instantly. So there you are. The Missing Years of Jesus.com comes up under a Blake search for poetry. So I thought that was a pretty wonderful thing. But I want to back up and I want to start us out here. People in the UK, I have found during my research going back and forth across the continents, that people in the UK, even if they don't understand it or have a grasp of it, they have usually heard this theory, this idea that Jesus was in southern England at some stage in his life. Or because of the Blake poem, which I'm going to ask you to get into as well, they have, you know, some sort of understanding that this was a possibility or certainly at least a legend. But I do find that when I mention this in the United States, that no one has any idea what I'm talking about. I think that this concept of Jesus being in the UK is something that is really, really new to Americans. And I know when I talk about it, they always look at me like I'm a little bit crazy, like it's just this completely insane idea, because they don't realize how much extraordinary cultural, archaeological, and folkloric evidence there is for this idea. So if you can indulge me and the American audience a little bit by just giving an overview for the newcomer, for the person who is really coming to this idea for the very first time, and talk us through a little bit about that, I would certainly appreciate it. I think it'd be great for the listeners to hear it.
I understand perfectly what you mean. I suppose that for people in Britain, William Blake's poem that he originally called and did those feet in ancient time, he wrote it in 1805. It was put to music in just after the First World War in Britain. And the long and the short of it is that the music was a masterpiece, and it was a masterpiece of marrying it to the words. And it's become Britain's most popular patriotic song. It's a song that's sung at weddings, at funerals, at sporting occasions. It's sung at the drop of the hat. Now, my American cousins are familiar with the tune, but you've changed the words. And the most famous example I know of the tune was sung at Ronald Reagan's funeral. And I think your words to it are, "O God of love, how strong and true," or something like that. So Americans are doubtless familiar with the tune, but not with the words, because I presume they didn't resonate in America.
And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green? That's my question for you.
Well, I personally don't doubt for a moment that they did, and I have no vested interest in it whatsoever. I mean, when I started to, I'd always been aware of the stories as far back as I can remember, but it was about 6 years ago that I started to seriously look into them. And when I consciously thought of this business of where was Jesus between the ages of 12 and 30, my first reaction was to buy the best book on the subject. But I looked around.
There wasn't one.
There wasn't one. It was as simple as that. So I was absolutely amazed by it. So the long and the short of it is that I set about writing my own. And I didn't intend to write a book in the first place. But when the sheer enormity of it dawned on me that here you have the most famous person who has ever existed. It doesn't matter what your beliefs are or your lack of beliefs. He's just the single most famous person that's ever existed. And there's this huge gap in his life between the ages of 12 and 30 where there is apparently no record. I couldn't think of any single other comparable figure from history that had such a gap. I mean, even someone like Attila the Hun that emerged from the steppes of Central Asia in the Dark Ages. We know that he had a brother, we know his father's name, we know something of his childhood. Even with a figure like King Arthur, that some people say is semi-legendary, we know about his birth in his early years and such like. But with Jesus, it just took a while for the enormity of it to dawn on me that the most famous man that's ever lived, and he's missing for over half his lifetime.
Absolutely.
It's not just over half his lifetime, it's his teenage years, his early adulthood, his formative years. It was all apparently a big blank.
And where did you start with this? And by the way, I was laughing when you said you went in search of a book for it and there wasn't one, because I certainly had the same experience when I first got into this a number of years ago, and I couldn't believe it. And they're really, it's so much effort. It's really requires a lot of research determination to go and find all this information yourself and put it all together, which is what you did and did brilliantly. So my question is, where did you start?
I'll answer your question as best I can. I mean, what I did when the enormity of this business dawned on me was that I just found myself casting around. I didn't know what to do or where to look. I was trying to look for this tall man with blue eyes and blonde hair wandering around Iron Age Britain 2,000 years ago. And I got absolutely nowhere. I was about to give up because I thought, it must be a fairy tale. I can't find anything at all. I didn't know where to look. I didn't have any idea of where to go because there was just this apparent nothingness. But the first and arguably the best thing that happened was that when I looked into Joseph of Arimathea, because there are numerous legends of Jesus in the west of England and in South Wales, and they were put together in the 20s and the 30s by three British clergymen. They collected these stories, and these men were vilified for their pains. But most of these stories mentioned a young Jesus coming to the west of England with Joseph of Arimathea. Now, as you doubtless know, Kathleen, Joseph of Arimathea is a very shadowy figure. He features in all four Gospels, but there are only 411 words on him in total in all those Gospels. And the British legends said that this man was in the tin trade, that he was a tin miner. And we know that tin was an extremely valuable commodity in the ancient world, because when you add it to copper, you get bronze. And bronze was the metal that all the wonderful treasures from the Temple of Solomon were made from. But all these stories spoke of Joseph of Arimathea being in the tin trade. So I sat down and I looked at the original Greek words in the Bible. I was lucky enough to have studied ancient Greek a long, long time ago when I was at school. I wouldn't describe myself as a genius, but I know enough to understand what's in front of me. And besides, there are some absolutely first-class translations on the internet. What I did before I did that was try to contact as many scholars as I could. And each time I got this utterly condescending reply that, oh, it's just a medieval invention, which left me scratching my head. I couldn't conceive of why people in medieval Britain were effectively sat around bored to death, and they all suddenly thought, I've got this great idea, let's pretend that the most famous guy who ever lived came to our particular neck of the woods and started digging for tin. I just couldn't buy it. So I looked at the original Greek, and this isn't any of the obscure Gospels. Anyone can find these translations online of the New Testament with the original Greek, and it's all broken down with the grammar, syntax, English translations, and such like. And I looked at these 411 words. I think it must have been for something like 3 months. And in the end, I thought, I'm looking for something that isn't there. I'm imagining it. And then finally, this one word leapt out at me, because in three of the Gospels, it says that when Joseph took Jesus' body down from the cross, he put the body in a new tomb. And that made me slightly suspicious, because I thought, whose new tomb was it? And I can't imagine that they'd have taken kindly to wandering around there the next day to find that the body of a condemned criminal had been put in their expensive sepulchre. But one of the Gospels, it said that Joseph cut the tomb himself. And when you look at the word is elatomason, and it literally means he carved, cut, quarried, or mined the rock. So I was absolutely astonished, because this isn't a matter for debate. You can look in the Greek dictionaries, you can consult any ancient Greek scholar. That's what it means. It meant that he cut it, or carved it, or quarried it, or mined it himself. So instantly, to me, it seemed that here was something in the Bible which verified these apparently nonsensical tales of Joseph being a tin miner. Mm-hmm. So it was good enough for me, but I went to check. Now, I'm not generally in the business of vilifying people, so I won't say who I went to check with, but I went to check with a very eminent man who was a New Testament scholar and an expert at ancient Greek. I walked into his study, you know, with an invitation, of course, and he didn't like me, and I simply have to say that the feeling was mutual. That was just it. And I asked him politely, would you please translate this line? So he read it out. It was very straightforward to him. He said, yes, Joseph of Arimathea cut the rock. I said, so that's what he did. There's no question about it. It says in the authorized version of the Bible that Joseph of Arimathea was a miner or a quarryman or someone who cut rock. And the gentleman just started spluttering, saying, yeah, but no, but yeah, it can't mean that. It does mean that. And, you know, I said, well, you know, I'll take my leave. I'm not going to argue. It either says it or it doesn't. And he said, well, you can't possibly have done it. And I said, well, what about the other parts in the Bible when someone kills a fatted calf or whatever? What am I to think, that they did it themselves and they got a servant to do it? I mean, you can't pick and choose. But anyway, that was the business. That was the thing that really excited me when I first found that there was some correlation that no one on earth can argue with.
Go ahead, Philip.
I just find it amazing that an academic can't even believe that somebody were to carve out a tomb. Kind of, how does an academic think tombs get created?
Well, but Philip, we know how academics are.
Uh-huh. This man was saying that because Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man, that he couldn't possibly have carved it himself. And I said, well, perhaps he became rich as a result of doing these things. It's not unthinkable that you can become a rich miner, a rich quarryman, a rich mason, a rich architect. But, you know, what I had to say was alien to his way of thinking, and so I left him, and that was that. And it's just for everyone to make up their own minds. It's in the book. It's online. You can make up your own mind. I'm not going to argue that black is white.
No, and you know what, and it's a brilliant point, and it's an exciting point, because there are those moments when we go back. Philip and I have found this a lot in our research, that etymology is your friend. When you go back to the origins of words and the way things are actually translated from the very beginning, that is where you get your best clues in your research, and you have to go back to the earliest sources. And so going back to the Greek is the only answer. And actually, we will put up on the Spirit Revolution website, we're going to put up all the information about where to get your book, Dennis. And I'll also put up some links to that particular place in the gospel that you're referring to, because this is really important stuff. I use a literal Greek translation of the New Testament, literally as my Bible, Richmond Lattimore's translation. Mm-hmm. And it's a translation that he went into as a Greek scholar and not as a biblical scholar. And it backs up so much of this information. And I think it's so important to look at this information from the original Greek before it was altered, because it really does change our understanding. Now, I could go off on a two-hour rant about academics and how frustrating it is.
I would happily listen to it, Kathleen, believe me.
I think, you know, we have a destiny in the future to sit down in a pub somewhere in the UK and just rant about academics together. But it's very, very frustrating.
They're not, they're not all bad. There are some very sincere men and women out there with some very clever minds, and I'm lucky enough to be in touch with one or two of them. But generally speaking, I'd be with you all the way.
Well, you know, the frustrating thing is, for those of us who are in an alternative type of research, our work is considered fringy, which is what I find so so incredibly frustrating, because we are digging deeper and looking harder than anyone has ever looked at history, because we are going beyond these extremely rigid rules and this very specific type of documentation, which just is rehashed over and over and over again in academia. And what is so exciting about what you're doing is that everything you do is, you know, in situ. You are out there. You are in the middle of it. You are looking for it. You are digging into it in ways that the academics have not done. And I so commend you for that. So my question for you is this. Now that we know that we have this information about Joseph being a tin trader, which I absolutely believe, what happens now? Where is Jesus in all of this?
Well, what I did next, once I found this business about Joseph of Arimathea being linked in the Bible to quarrying or mining, I had what I hoped was another bright idea. Instead of chasing this man around the west of England, I decided to treat the whole thing as a missing persons investigation. This is the kind of thing that's become, well, I wouldn't say popular because it's not a happy pastime, but, you know, most people must surely be aware of crime programs where you try to research the whereabouts of someone who's gone missing. In the case of Jesus, it was even more simple because we know that he reappeared. And so I tried to look at the characteristics of the human being that I read about in the Bible to see what characteristics he'd acquired in his bearing, his demeanor, what skills he had and such like, to see if that would give any clue as to where he'd been. So I went to the beginning. I looked at him as a 12-year-old boy. If we're to believe the stories, he was destined to be a messiah, which was a warrior mystic who would drive the Romans out of his homeland. The last mention in the Bible is when he was 12 years old, and he was found in the temple after the Feast of the Passover. And what it exactly says is that he amazed the elders with his understanding of the scriptures. And so it's obvious there was a huge crowd gathered around him, and he was making a name for himself. And my best and most informed guess is that if a mere 12 years before a star had appeared over your birthplace and three wise men had come from the east and such like, and you were being prophesied as someone who'd rise to eminence, then if you were starting to be a teenager, spouting off and being full of yourself, then sooner or later attention is going to be drawn to you. And I would imagine that those people in his family were wary of this. So it wouldn't have been a healthy place to be. There had been other Jewish messiahs, you know, just a few years before, who had risen up against the Romans, who came to a sticky end. So it must have been obvious to Jesus' family that this wasn't a healthy situation. When you look at where he lived, it's just a mere 30 miles or so away from the coastline of present-day Lebanon. But in ancient times, this was Phoenicia, and there were ports such as Tyre and Sidon that were renowned throughout the world for the skill of their sailors. And we know from Roman accounts that these sailors from that specific part of the world had travelled all the way through the Mediterranean, past the Pillars of Hercules, into the North Atlantic, and they'd even gone to the North Sea between Britain and Scandinavia. So it was literally about a day's walk away, a lifeline to go to these ports where you could have a new life. And then I asked myself, well, where in this hypothetical situation, where is it he would want to go? And every single time, Britain comes up as the sole destination of choice.
Because for people who are not really that familiar with like mining in Europe, there are really very few places in Europe, in fact in the world, where tin can be mined. I think Cyprus is one of them, but by far the largest and most famous in antiquity was Cornwall and that part of southern England where actually you live.
That's right. I mean, it was the destination of choice for traders from that part. But when I asked myself, you know, how would Britain register at the time to the perception of someone in Judea or Galilee or in Phoenicia, about 60 years before Jesus' time, Julius Caesar had twice famously invaded Britain in 55 and 54 BC. He was the most famous general that the Romans had ever produced, arguably the greatest as well. And his version of events was that he had invaded Britain twice, but really couldn't be bothered to take over the whole thing, so he went back home. But I very much doubt that that's how the Britons saw it, or how the rest of the people under the yoke of the Roman Empire saw it. It was this strange island. It was visible across what's now the English Channel. On a clear day, you could see it from Gaul. They defeated the Romans twice. There were, of course, the Druids there, this strange priesthood that claimed descent from a single heavenly father. They wore white. They'd beaten the Romans. All manner of things to make someone like Jesus or his family intrigued about it. And of course, at the furthest end of the Roman Empire, a place that wasn't under Roman occupation, it just seems like the ideal place to go. You have work there, you have the tin trade, you have natives and locals who are hostile to Rome, and you have these intriguing stories of the inhabitants about their beliefs, which, you know, lots of people apart from myself have looked into and have thought were not incompatible with Christianity as it should ideally be.
And let's talk about that for a minute. So based on your findings and what you believe through these findings, what do you think happens spiritually with Jesus while he is in the UK?
Well,
prior to it being the UK, of course.
I think just going from what we read in the Bible, that he was a scriptural prodigy when he was 12 years old. And it's all very well to know your scriptures inside out, as many people these days do. But there's a world of difference from being able to recite something parrot fashion to being spiritually aware in whatever way you care to look at it. All the stories that place Jesus in Britain, none of them speak of him as an outcast or a fugitive or anything like that. They describe him working with the miners in Cornwall and in the Mendips. And that and a lot of other information seems to me that he was left to his own devices, that he was left to get on with whatever he wanted to do. And so, to cut a very long story short, my take on it is that he spent as many as 18 years in Britain just formulating his ministry, as simply as that. Because when he reappears at the age of 30, and I hate this expression, but, you know, he hit the ground running. He was never caught out. He had this crystal clear vision, an iron will and determination. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, what he wanted to say. He arbitrated in disputes between normal people with his own people, with Romans, with the Pharisees and such like. And I have yet to find one occasion where he had to retire to say, oh, I'll have to think this one over, come back to me tomorrow. He never had to do that. When he appeared in his ministry, he had all the answers. He had a clear mm-hmm. vision of what he wanted. I don't think you could have acquired something like that unless you had had all the time that was necessary for you to sit down and contemplate what you were going to do.
And so in this process, do you see Joseph of Arimathea as Jesus' guardian, as his mentor, as a relative? How do you perceive him in his relationship to Jesus here?
Everything I've read suggests to me that Joseph of Arimathea was Jesus' uncle.
I believe that too.
Yes. It just seems fairly obvious. I mean, the most obvious thing is that he asked Pilate for the body of Jesus after the crucifixion. And everything I've read says that it was only a close family relative that was allowed to do such a thing. If Joseph, as the Bible itself suggests, was involved with mining and quarrying and such like, then he must have been a pretty tough guy, a pretty worldly guy, and someone who was familiar with the world beyond the immediate surroundings of Jerusalem and Nazareth. You know, he was someone that had traveled. So as Jesus was missing for 18 years, then it seems to me that Joseph of Arimathea must have started off in the first place as an employer, perhaps as a grudging employer. Perhaps he didn't want to take this 12-year-old kid with him. But he would also have been his guardian as well, if I'm right about being his uncle. So I presume logic suggests that he took him away to this land at the end of the known world and watched him grow. So he went from being the guardian to the one person who had the courage to go and ask Pilate for his body and went to bury him as well. So I presume that Joseph's function changed over the years, because he was described as the only secret disciple of Jesus, something mm-hmm. that absolutely baffles me, the only secret one. Mm-hmm. Why should that be?
And there are so many questions, because this is such a huge subject, and my mind's going in a million directions. And I want to tell you this story about Jesus in Ireland that comes from an Irish legend, but I don't want to get off track. But, I want to just back up for a minute, because one of the things I'm thinking, going back to this whole idea of Joseph as a minor and finding this Greek literal translation, meaning that Joseph actually cut the rock, right?
He quarried it.
But it looks definitely like a quarrying, mining kind of term. Certainly indicates that he created this tomb. Now, if we are looking at Jesus, as you said, Star of Bethlehem, three wise men, prophesied Messiah, from the minute he arrives, everybody knows who and what he is. Now, I don't think it is so crazy to believe that someone who cared for him or was a member of his family would have begun creating a very special tomb for him, not different from the pharaohs building pyramids, and other sort of major leaders and people of stature creating large sepulchres or other kinds of tombs for themselves upon their death. So this is what I'm thinking. If Jesus is the Messiah and everyone knows that this is what he's going to be, wouldn't we want to create a place ultimately to honor him? And wouldn't someone like a Joseph of Arimathea be the one to create something like that?
Well, it seems a fairly straightforward matter to me, Kathleen. I just don't see any problem with it. If the Bible describes him as it does, as such a person who cut or quarried rock, and he was a rich man as well, then I don't see any problem with that. I mean, the description of the tomb as well, it was big enough for two angels or two guardians to be found sat in there the next day. And to invite in, according to which gospel you believe, a group of women, carrying bundles of cloths and such like. And the angels invited the people the next morning to have a look around to check that the body wasn't there. Now, even if you only take a second or two to look around to check it's not there, it must have been a decent-sized sepulchre. You're not talking about something like a broom cupboard. It was,
no.
a decent-sized thing, if I can just go back to something else, you were talking about academics earlier, and there's the business of evidence of Jesus being in Britain. One of the things that amazed me was I found the existence of some coins. They were minted in the Iron Age by a tribe who lived in Somerset. They were called the Duboni. And these coins had the name Esu written on them. The name Esu was spelled E-I-S-U. And everything that I've ever read tells me that these coins were minted in the west of England to commemorate someone who rose to prominence between AD 15 and AD 30. And it's all in the public domain. Anyone can type into Google, look up these coins. You can find pictures of them. And it absolutely astonished me that there was a name so close to the Greek name of Jesus that had been stamped on these coins in exactly the same part of the world and at exactly the same time that all the legends place him there. But I couldn't find a single other archaeologist or numismatist or historian that had so much as passed comment on it. Nobody's even said, isn't this a strange coincidence? No, I don't know.
But well, do these numismatists or other archaeologists, do they have any theory on what these coins are and what they actually do refer to?
Well, they assume that it was that the name Izu was the name of a tribal chieftain at the time, which is fine.
Please.
It may have been the case, but I just could not believe that these legends have been known about for so long, at the very, very least, going back to when William Blake wrote this poem in 1805, although they were certainly known of before that time. These coins have been found. They're not obscure things. Anyone can look them up. And I just couldn't fathom why nobody even so much as passed comment, why nobody had said, what a strange coincidence. Fancy that. Isn't that odd? No, there was a deathly silence about it. I'm not generally a conspiracy theorist, but the mere fact that nobody had uttered a word about it. What is the harm in saying, is that not an amazing coincidence? All these legends place this man here between the ages of 12 and 30, and these coins commemorated a man who had a name remarkably similar, who rose to prominence between at the same time.
Dennis, I love what you've discovered about these coins, and I'm fascinated by it, and I am definitely going to dig into it and see if I can get some pictures to put up on the Spirit Revolution website, because I think it's something that really bears looking into some more. Because one of the things I discovered when I was doing the deepest pieces of my research on Mary Magdalene and her arrival in France and started really digging, what I discovered is Jesus was always referred to on the continent by the Greek version of his name. I get a lot of mail because in my books I refer to him as Issa, which is sort of the pet form of the Greek version of his name, Isis. And I get a lot of mail from people who say, why do you call him Issa? Why do you call him Issa? And I say, well, because I actually believe that that's what his family called him. And I believe that that's what Magdalene called him because that's what I've discovered people refer to him as in a number of these sort of Gnostic sects and secret societies even. But the information that he was used, that his Greek name was used to refer to him, I think is really powerful and really important. And again, it's something that people don't talk about very much. They talk about Yeshua and Yehoshua, and they look at the Aramaic versions and they look at the Hebrew versions. But the fact is, this was a Hellenistic society that used the Greek very, very often. So this idea that these coins have something that potentially refers to Jesus's Greek name is not in the least bit far-fetched, and I think extremely exciting.
Well, so I'm inclined to think as well. And as you pointed out, Kathleen, I mean, this isn't hidden knowledge. If anyone so much as delves into the area and the time, you learn that Greek was the common language. The testaments were written in Greek. There's every chance, and lots of mainstream Christian scholars write about this, that there's every likelihood that Jesus regularly spoke in Greek to make himself understood. And yes, that's when you move away from Yeshua and Jesus and stuff like that onto the Greek version of his name. And this was, again, something that surprised me about these coins, because when Jesus is addressed in the Bible, he is addressed as Yesu. I won't bother trying to spell out the Greek letters, but it's so close to what's written on these coins. And the fact that these coins commemorated someone who rose to prominence in the same area that the legends placed Jesus at exactly the same time just struck me as a fantastic coincidence, which is why I remarked upon them in my book. But my point again is that why was I the first to do it? Why could not someone decades ago have just simply pointed out what an interesting coincidence this is? And when people don't do that, then I become mildly even more suspicious than usual.
Well, this is a topic that Philip and I discuss often on this show. And this is, what are historians afraid of? What are academics afraid of? Because whether it's Egyptology or biblical scholarship or Tudor history, we find this over and over again. People are terrified to think outside of the box and to even ask the questions. And that's the part that I don't understand. Okay, you may not, as an academic, like the evidence because it's not something that you can follow up with a document. it. But the fact is, there is this incredibly interesting archaeological evidence, or in some cases cultural evidence, that at least should make us ask questions. And why aren't we asking those questions? But thank God, people like you are.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, Kathleen, and I might be able to shed just a tiny bit of light on this through personal experience. I very much doubt that any of your American listeners will be familiar with the world of British archaeology, but we're a small island. Archaeology is a much sought-after profession, and as far as I'm aware, there are only about 20,000 people working in it at any one time, and people are desperate to be paid to work as archaeologists, and loads of very well-meaning people study it at university and such like. But once you're in the archaeological profession, there's a great deal of bitterness, enviousness, and resentment. People want to get on, and they don't like seeing other people get on. So in my experience, if you have someone that casts a sympathetic eye over any of these notions, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's William Blake, Jesus in Britain, theories about Stonehenge, dowsing, the paranormal, anything that's completely off the beaten track, you will have a host of resentful people keeping their eyes open, and they're ready to pounce instantly on someone else, one of their fellows, to make them look stupid, and in their twisted logic, to enhance their own standing. They particularly go in for willful misrepresentation of what someone has read. Now, I've spent a lot of time studying Stonehenge, and I've been up to the excavations there that are run by the Stonehenge Riverside Project. And I'm familiar with other archaeological works as well. And one of the frustrating things is that these intelligent, well-meaning men and women have to agonize over every single last word that they write, because unless it's absolutely neutral and the words are chosen exactly, then the vultures are out there and they'll jump on anything in a paper and they'll say this person's mad because he's saying such and such. And that's the way it is. It's a venomous, toxic attitude that not all of them, but a lot of them are guilty of. I mean, I've had a lot of media attention on account of my Stonehenge studies and on account of this book. The vast majority of correspondence I get from it is generous in spirit, and people don't agree with what I say, but they're happy for me to have spoken about it. But there's always this small, hardcore, deeply unpleasant, inadequate, bitter, resentful individuals who are out there, and the internet allows them to have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is. That's the world we live in, I suppose.
Well, and it's the same is true in historical circles and biblical circles as well. And Philip and I are going through it right now with our research on Anne Boleyn, and even, just sort of leaking some of the new things we found about her, the barrage of just pure hate that is being rained upon us for even defending her or saying that that there is new information, is spectacular, and really tragic to me. It's so incredibly sad.
Who do you think you are, isn't it, Kathleen?
Oh, absolutely. How dare you?
Who do you think you are?
I have had people on the Facebook discussion groups, on other discussion sites. How dare you say you can find something new? How dare you say you're better than everyone who's out there? I'm not saying that I'm better. I'm just saying that we look in different places and we look from a different perspective. And I don't understand. I will never understand. This is perhaps my naivete of the world. I will never understand why we are all in this field so heavily criticized all the time, because it never stops, for trying to find new information and for caring enough to keep looking. I don't understand why that's considered a negative trait. So for me, I have learned to wear the scarlet letter of the anti-historian proudly, because I had to. Right?
Yeah.
Yes, I am the anti-academic. Yeah. But, the thing that also I find frustrating is a lot of the criticism comes from, what we refer to as armchair historians and armchair archaeologists and people who never leave their keyboard, right? People who have never been to see a tunic cross, people who have never been to Glastonbury. history, people who have never, you know, I talk about this all the time. We've got biblical scholars here in America, people with PhDs, who slam my work on Mary Magdalene and say there's no proof that she was ever in France. They've never been to France. And I've even offered to buy them plane tickets, and they still won't go to France.
There comes
a point where it's incredibly frustrating, but I've almost learned how to use it as fuel. It energizes me. It makes me all the more determined to keep going. And I hope that the same is true of you.
Well, since my book's come out, it's been out about a year or so now, and it was quite frustrating at first. I got a lot of correspondence from people saying that their Christian friends or family didn't want to pick my book up. And someone put it very well. They said they were hopeful about what they'd find, but the fear of what they thought was in there outweighed the hope of something new about the person that they revere. But I've had loads of letters since then from devout men and women who are Christians who've written the most wonderful letters to me about this book, thanking me for having written it. They don't necessarily say that they buy into my conclusions or that they agree with me, and that's absolutely fine. But I don't mind in the least about that. But it's so gratifying that they have this intense curiosity about the whole life of the person that they revere, and that my book has given them something to think about. To me, it's a very simple and straightforward matter. I don't mind saying it. I don't doubt for a minute that Jesus spent as many as 18 years in the west of Britain. I think there's evidence to suggest why he left his homeland. There's evidence to suggest why Britain would have been the sole destination of choice, especially the west of England. And we're getting into details, things such as prophecies by Isaiah and Malachi and such like. There are legends of him here. There are artifacts such as the tunic crosses and possibly these coins, and I don't doubt that something else will come to light soon as well. And I also think that when he returns home, a lot of the characteristics he shows demonstrate that he spent time in Britain. That's what I think, but if people agree with me, great. If they don't, I don't mind. But but weighing against the bile and misrepresentation that I've had, I'm delighted at the private letters from private individuals who've written to me, who are devout Christians, who think my book is absolutely great. They're so pleased by it because it's given them food for thought, and that's the highest praise I could ask for, I suppose.
Well, that's the victory. I mean, that is absolutely the real victory for everybody, is that you have touched so many people and opened up their eyes and their hearts and their minds. And for me, anyone who wants to have a greater understanding of Jesus, you know, is a real heartfelt Christian. And those who are so constricted that they're not interested in hearing another point of view, I think they're really missing out. I feel great sympathy for them. So
you're more generous-spirited than I am, Kathleen, that's for sure. I've had some prize-winning idiots write about me here in Britain. You know, just telling. I mean, I had a review recently. I presume I can mention this, in the Catholic Herald.
And our mutual enemy, yes.
Well, the idiot who wrote the review just lied through his back teeth about me. I really couldn't care less. If that's what he wants to do, then that's fine. You know, the universe is unfolding as it should, and such like.
Right.
But I thought, why bother lying? You know, you can vilify me. You can say whatever you like about me. You can twist the truth. If you despise me that much, if you think I'm so ignorant and whatever, then go ahead. You know, find all the faults you want with the book. But I think if you're reduced as the first step to lying through your back teeth, as Mr. Barrett was, then it's a sorry state of affairs. It really is. And, you know, he's welcome to do it. I don't mind, because I still get not just a flow of letters, but I get a flow of new information about the missing years of Jesus. One thing which might interest you, a month or so ago, I had a letter. It came out of the blue, and there was a wonderful old-fashioned monograph inside, a beautiful privately produced booklet, and it had been sent to me by a gentleman in South Wales, and he was an amateur historian, and he's deeply religious man, as I understand it, and there's a tiny hill in South Wales, and it's called Craig y Pal. I hadn't heard about it, because I can't be all-knowing, but this gentleman learned about this place. There's a preaching stone there, and there are traditions that St. Paul visited the place, and that it had connections with the very earliest Christianity in Britain. And this gentleman had consulted, to the very best of his ability, men and women who were experts at language, at geology, everything he could think of, and he'd done this examination into this tiny hill in South Wales, which I had never heard of, and it absolutely fascinated me. And he'd also quoted my book in there, because my book had been brought to his attention while he was in the middle of his own private research, so my book brought joy into his life, and I was overjoyed to see that someone else out there, unbeknownst to me, had been working at the same thing, and you know, they'd come up with this just absolutely fascinating study of a tiny hill in South Wales, which seems to have some links with the very, very earliest Christianity in Britain. So all these good things, Kathleen, outweigh the idiots. The world's full of them, but you know, I'm human as well. Every now and again I get more than mildly irritated, but they're, you know, the world's full of good, well-meaning people.
Of course.
Tacking on two things there, actually, in one of the I recently wrote an article on the Shroud, and we've discussed on this show the Shroud as well. And one of the things which the person said, like, it's a great article, he said, but I'm convinced it's a medieval fraud for this very simple reason. The man on the Shroud has got long hair, and kind of like, you know, nobody in Judea at that moment in time would have long hair. Well, let's assume that everybody in Judea actually didn't have long hair. But actually, it's kind of like, you know, like, let's just go from that assumption for a second.
Even though it's wrong.
kind of like, you know, there was a tradition, specifically in Britain at the time, whereby the Druids did have very long hair. So, kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, you can play with that. But that's kind of like just a random thought. The thing is this, that Jesus likely, if not definitely, came to England in his lifetime. He came across there the beautiful things of Stonehenge, Avebury, a very important sacred region, which had just been cleared from thousands of years, 2,000-3,000 of years of Druidic culture. And then we also know that there are legends that after Jesus's death, Joseph of Arimathea seems to have come back to there. So there seems to have been something there which still was able to attract the person of Joseph of Arimathea to kind of like think that actually this might be a really good school, a really good kind of like educational program, if you want, going abroad for Jesus. What have you done any research as to what kind of traditions, what kind of things were going on in this wake of the Roman clearing the Druids out of that region?
Well, I'm very interested in looking into you know, the classical accounts of the Druids, because, I mean, this is a huge subject, so I'll keep it as brief as I possibly can. As I said earlier, there are 411 words in the Bible on Joseph of Arimathea. A lot of academics, or supposed academics, like to put it about that we know next to nothing about the Druids, but there are actually 4,000 words that survive from classical times. So if I was able to find one shining gem about Joseph of Arimathea being a miner, then I can't sidetrack onto this, but I assure you and all your listeners, it's available online. You can look at all the classical accounts of the Druids. There's 4,000 words there. There's a mountain of information about these men and women. So I wouldn't know where to start, but we know that the Romans were very keen on destroying the Druids. They tried to do so on the island of Anglesey in North Wales in AD 60. And that seems to have been when Druidic power came to an end. But I don't doubt for a minute that it prospered for a long time afterwards. And it was certainly at its height at the time when I am sure that Jesus came to this country. But if I can go back to the subject of hair for a second, Philip, perhaps I'm fortunate. You know, I have, aside from the idiots that there are out there, I have a number of very clever and intelligent and shrewd friends who are devout Christians. And I've spoken to them about long hair is traditionally a sign of rebellion. It certainly is in our times. We know that the ancient Britons wore long hair as well. And their simple take on it is that they revere Jesus and they look at his lifetime and he was a radical. He had these absolutely bizarre notions about women being equal, for example. And he spoke to Roman centurions and healed their servants. He did all these radical things. He wasn't afraid of anyone at all. Now, we know his cousin, John the Baptist, went into the wilderness at roughly the same age and lived off locusts and wild honey and so on. So while Jesus strikes me as an intelligent and a sophisticated man, a great orator with all these other attributes, I still have this image that he was nobody's, he was his own man, and that's it. So long hair to me is compatible with the idea that he spent time in Britain, but long hair because he was different. If everyone else had short hair, then that is a guarantee for me that Jesus would have had long hair. And it's as simple as that. You know, he was a rebel, and, you know, he would have been different to the others.
I like the fact that all three of us here are rebels by that account.
Well, you know, it certainly is a hallmark in our own times. I suppose, you know, people have Mohicans and all sorts of things, but I suppose the common point is that your hair is important to you. Even if you shave it all off, that's still an expression of your identity. It's a really important thing. Some people want to cover it up, some of us grow it long and such like. But I'm sure that it was the same back then. So when you mention about this man on the Turin Shroud having long hair, then I don't doubt for a moment that Jesus had long hair as well. I think everything points towards that.
Where are you going to take this next? Is this, writing this book, The Missing Years of Jesus, the end for you? Or what's ahead in your research on The Missing Years of Jesus?
Well, I'm in the fortunate position of having a website up. Every now and again, Philip, someone sends me in some gem of information. I'm still, you know, fascinated by the subject. I can't help but be. I can't imagine not being so. A little while ago, someone wrote in to me. He was a gentleman from South Wales. The long and the short of it is that he had his DNA tested by the National Geographic Society, their genographic project. And he had discovered that he was of mixed Jewish and Phoenician ancestry. It amazed him. It didn't surprise me too much. There are all sorts of explanations for it. But when I get information of that quality coming in on a regular basis, and the other people who sent me this beautiful monograph about this preaching stone that I didn't know about and such like, and I get other people writing to me to say, did you know the story in Gloucestershire or Worcestershire that Mary visited the place, then I've got a growing mountain of material here, and I'm just trying to make sense of it, trying to make the most of it. But it's something that just absolutely fascinates me, and I fail to see how anyone cannot be interested by it. How can you not wonder whether I'm right or wrong, I hasten to add, you know, how can you not wonder where the most famous man who ever lived spent his teenage years, his early adulthood, his formative years. And to me, it all points to the west of England, but we must all make up our own minds on that.
Let me ask you this. What is it you think that scares people about this? Because
here's the part, Catherine,
that I don't understand.
Kathleen, I understand perfectly. Lots of people love my book. They love the evidence that I've presented. They buy into it. But the problem that a lot of people have with it is that if Jesus did spend as many as 18 years in Britain, which I think all the evidence suggests that he did, then the implication is that he got on like a house on fire with the locals, who were these pagan monsters of antiquity. They were druids and everything else. And people can't accept that someone that they revere so much could possibly have grown up amongst people who later historians portray as savages and barbarians. And of course, it was the Romans that wrote that about what a bloodthirsty bunch they were. And I think that's what the reservation people have. You have a mental picture of Jesus in the Holy Land, in the desert and such like. And it doesn't matter what evidence that I present or anyone else presents, for a lot of people it's impossible to make that mental leap to see him on England's pleasant pastures and green mountains.
Well, you certainly remind me of these last lines in the Blake poem. I will not cease from mental fights, nor shall my sword sleep in my hands till we have built Jerusalem. So I dedicate those lines to you, Dennis, for how much you have inspired me. I love your work. I'm your biggest fan. I just want to say that right out.
Well, it's so kind of you. That really is, Kathleen, and thank you so much for wanting to talk to me. I'm truly honored.
This is another edition of The Spirit Revolution. Until next time.
The truth against the world.